Okay, there are two parts of this week's parsha. I mean, the truth is, we could subdivide it even more, but there's two. There's two basic parts. I only see neshamot. I don't see anything else. The first part is the whole Bilam, Balak, donkey part of the portion. And at the end, there is this postscript. The truth is, the first part we can divide further, the introduction, the preamble, the negotiations, the traveling to the Israelite camp, the various attempts to curse the people, and finally the blessings that the Jewish people receive. Should I assume that you already know all this?
No.
Or should I assume that we don't know anything? We don't know anything, so we have a problem, but let's then go back to the beginning. The first part, which I'm calling the first three quarters of the portion, I'll tell you what's interesting about it. Again, if you don't know anything about this, I can say anything I want. The first part, what's interesting about it, is it has the type of discussion that some of us wonder what it would sound like. Some of us have been in that discussion, listening in, feeling somewhat uncomfortable. Which discussion is that? When non-Jews are talking about Jews. Which means, what's interesting over here is the whole first part of it, there are no Jews in the discussion. We're not part of it. We're on the side. We're the object that they're speaking about. We're not part of the dialogue. Which means, if you contrast this for a moment with a very natural contrast, and that is the whole negotiations between Moses and Pharaoh. Here Moses comes in, let my people go, right? You've seen the movie, this you know, right? This is okay? Here we have Pharaoh as a prototypical, for lack of a better term, anti-Semite. He sees that he has some kind of right, perhaps a divine right, to rule the people. He's born to be king. They're born to be slaves. Any adjustment within this would cause havoc. And that's the way it's been, and that's the way it should remain. And when Moses comes in, let my people go, that's an absurdity. Now, I'll tell you something which I find fascinating. The rabbis tell us that Pharaoh actually had three advisors. Now, this is not necessarily meant to be a historical perspective as much as it's meant to be a thematic analysis. Now, I'll explain to you what I mean by that. Who are his three advisors? One is the protagonist from this week, Bilam. A second one is Jethro, Yisro. The third one is also another famous biblical figure who, again, at face value has nothing to do with any of this, and his name is Eov, Job. Says that he asks the three of them, and let's admit it, he's under a bit of pressure. Let's see, you guys withstand plague, we got a plague, frogs, lice, whatever. He's under some pressure, and he turns to his advisors and says, how do I solve the Jewish problem? Once you formulate the problem that way, it already leads you in a certain direction. How do I solve the Jewish problem? So according to this rabbinic discussion, Bilam, again, the guy from this week, he says, the way to solve the Jewish problem is annihilation. So there you go. Long before you had Nazis, long before you had Goebbels, long before you had Hitler, any of these people, solve the Jewish problem, annihilation. The second one, Jethro, Yisro, he then says that it's immoral to kill innocent people. It's one thing to go to war when there's a justification. It's quite another thing to destroy innocent people. And he says that absolutely Pharaoh should treat them ethically and fairly. What you see right then, again, I'm saying it's a thematic analysis, is what's the Jewish attitude towards non-Jews? Again, we'll get back to this week. What's the attitude of non-Jews towards Jews? But what's the attitude of Jews towards non-Jews? So what does Judaism say? Non-Jews are all good or non-Jews are all bad? What does it say? That people are people are people. There are some very good, decent, moral non-Jews. There are some very evil non-Jews. And there's also people who may even be in the middle. Who's the one in the middle? So Eov, Job. What does Job say? So now, what does Job generally say in the Bible? What is Job known for? He's known for his silence. Job doesn't say anything. Job is silent. So what does Job say according to this Midrashic interpretation? He basically says, I prefer to retain neutrality. This is not my business. Job is Switzerland. Now, the truth is, if you're silent or you're neutral, when one protagonist are Nazis, that does not make you look all that good afterward. And by the way, it's fascinating, because if you read through the book of Job, you'll notice something which is interesting. Job, was he a good person or a bad person?
Good.
Sounds like a real good person. God said he's a good person. If God said he's a good person, you know, that's good enough for me. I don't have to go any further. He's a good person. Here's the more difficult part. What makes him good? Now, you have to stop right there, because if I were to tell you that Abraham is a good person, I would then ask you, what makes Abraham good? Would you be able to answer that question? Abraham, by the way, sets standards that would embarrass all of us. Because none of us, again, I'm sorry, I don't even know you, I'm already insulting you. None of us have the ability of really standing up to Abraham's standards. If I had to write a biography about Abraham's goodness, two things jump off right away. One thing that jumps to mind is his willingness, his energy, and his excitedness about taking care of strangers. The way the rabbis embellish the point is that he opens up his tent facing the desert. So when people come in after an incredibly long trip coming out of the desert, he's standing there waiting to take them into his home, to give them a place to rest, to give them food, to give them something to drink, in order to help them from their travels. And more than that, when they would say, thank you, Abraham, you're the nicest guy we ever met, you know what he would say? Don't thank me, thank God. Make a blessing on the fruit, make a blessing on the drink, thank God. And that's Abraham. Abraham sees God as being a being which is fundamentally good. Abraham, who's a great philosopher, says, if there is a God, and Abraham discovers God, if there is a God, and God is all-powerful, and God is infinite, then by definition it must mean that God does not need anything. And if God doesn't need anything, then creation cannot be because God needs something. Rather, God creates because God is something which none of us can possibly imagine as well. What is that? That's why we're difficult with Abraham. What is God? God is completely altruistic. Look, any of you who grew up in New York do not know what this word means. If you grew up in New York and someone's nice to you, you get real scared. Right? The scariest thing happened to me growing up is taking a subway in New York and somebody from across the train smiles at me. Is that frightening? It happened to be someone I went to high school with, I hadn't seen in 5 years. But the guy smiled at me the other side of the thing. Is that scary or not? It's a good thing I wasn't Israel. Good thing I didn't have a gun on me. Someone's nice to you? You get frightened. And so the concept of altruism, the concept of somebody doing good for the sake of doing good, the concept of somebody doing good and not want anything in return is something which is quite foreign to us. Abraham has this realization that if God creates and God is infinite, God doesn't need anything, that means that God is by definition good. And God is by definition doing things without wanting anything in return. And Abraham therefore tries to emulate God and tries to do good for the sake of doing good. And that, as I said, that's an incredible standard. That's one thing that jumps out. What's the other thing that jumps out? Is that when God says, I'm going to destroy the city of Sodom, Abraham's response, and this is something which is also quite remarkable. And I challenge, okay, I won't make fun of you now, I challenge any rabbi in this country to live up to the same standards. Because think about it a second. If you were to go over to most people today and say, I'm about to get rid of your enemies. Think about it. Abraham is somebody who's based upon goodness and kindness. The city of Sodom, the banner which they fly, is a banner of being anti-friendly and anti-nice, which means if he has a message that he wants to share with the world, the people who are the biggest obstacle to that message being accepted are the people of Sodom. These are his theological enemies. These are his moral enemies. And when God comes and says to him, I will obliterate your enemies, what does he say? It wouldn't be moral for the judge of the entire earth to do something which is not just. How can you do that, God? Maybe there are righteous people there. How can you just go and wipe out a whole city? And by the way, he's saying maybe there's righteous people. He doesn't say save the righteous. What he's really saying is perhaps the righteous could impact on the people who are not righteous yet. Which means instead of having the attitude, obliterate all enemies, Abraham's attitude is, we can impact these people. Never give up on people. Do you know what Abraham's telling us? You can put this on a bumper sticker afterwards. You can take full credit for it. Abraham is saying that the greatest natural resource in this world, in this universe, is love. And the more you use it, the more it grows. And therefore, hatred is something which has no place. Love will grow exponentially. And he really believes in humanity. And he really believes that these people can be redeemed. And therefore, when God comes and says, listen, I'll do you a favor, I'll wipe out all your enemies, what does he say? I don't accept that. I'd rather have them over Friday night. That's what Abraham is saying. And as I said, it's a remarkable standard. Now, when you compare Abraham with Job, what does Job say? Job says nothing. What makes Abraham good? His belief in humanity, all of humanity. His prayer for his enemies. That's what makes him great. And then you look at the beginning of Job and you see something which is fascinating. It tells us that Job was a good person, a rightful person, a righteous person. Do you know what made Job good? It's a minimalistic definition of good. What made Job good is he didn't do bad. A lot of us have the same definition of good. What's a good person? A good person is somebody who doesn't do bad. Any of you who didn't rape and pillage and murder today, you're all good, decent people. By the way, does that really make you good? Or do you need something more? In Jewish writings, there's a concept of, in the Psalms, Sur Mira, stay away from evil, va'aseh tov, and do good. By Job, all you find is Sur Mira. You find somebody who's God-fearing and stays away from evil. But you don't find somebody who's proactive and does something which is good. Do you realize the difference between them? The difference is the impact they're going to have on a larger society. I'll tell you the condemning verse that the rabbis say about Job. And when I say it to you, you're not going to hear it being such a condemnation. You're not going to feel that there was something so bad that happened here. It said that Job, every day, would bring offerings according to the number of his children. He brought offerings to God and he prayed to God according to the number of his children. That's a condemnation. Hold it, does that sound so bad? Shouldn't every parent pray to God for their children? God, take care of my kids. It's a real prayer. What's the problem? Because he didn't pray for anyone else's kids. That's the problem. He didn't feel anybody else's pain. And if, again, in this conversation, Pharaoh can say, what do I do about the Jewish problem? And he can answer, well, it's not really my business, and I'm taking a neutral stance. What's he telling you? He's saying that a genocide can take place, but it's none of his business. It has nothing to do with him. And God then says, if the only pain that you feel is your own pain, by God, I will give you your own pain. Because that's the only thing that's going to get your attention. And if you want to understand the resolution of the book of Job, 30 chapters, I just saved you a whole book. 30-something chapters later, God then says to him, now pray for your friends. Pray for other people. Don't just pray for yourself. Which means ultimately, I didn't have to tell you this, but ultimately, if Switzerland can say that we're neutral in terms of Nazis versus Jews, this isn't our business, we're not taking sides. When you don't take sides, when there's a genocide taking place, what you've done is you've condemned yourself because you cannot be, quote-unquote, pariv towards genocide. But let's go back a couple of steps. Who was the individual, nonetheless, who said, obliterate them? That's our hero from this week's portion. That's Bilam. Bilam is willing to get rid of people. He's willing to genocide. And by the way, it's even better. It's even, depending on which side you're on, it's either better than that or worse than that. There's a guy named Balak. Balak is a king. And he sees what's been going on. It's very interesting. The verse, the portion begins, Vayar Balak ben Sipor, es kol asher asah Yisrael le'amori. A man named Balak ben Sipor saw what the Jews did to the Amori. That's a battle that took place last week. Vayagur Moav bnei ha'am, and the people of Moav became very frightened against the Jews. Ki Ravu, of course, there were so many of them. Vayakatz Moav bnei b'nei Yisrael. And Moav became disgusted in the face of Israel. This is not the Jews that disgusted them. Vayoma Moav el ziknei Midyon. And Moav said to the elders of Midyon, Ata now, yilachlechu ha-kahal es kol sivivosenu, ki lechol chashor es yerek asada. These people are going to come, and they are going to obliterate everything in front of us, the same way that a flock of cows would come and eat up all of the grass. But by the way, this sounds, again, like classic anti-Semitic descriptions of the Jews. It's all over the place. There are so many of them. They destroy the world, destroy the natural resources. And then it makes a very interesting comment. Uvolok ben Sipor melech l'moav ba'esahi. And at that time, Balak ben Sipor was the king of Moab. Now, the Torah is not written in a way which is simplistic. It's written in a way that requires our attention because it's full of subtlety and requires our study. And there are all kinds of levels. We'll see how much you behave, how many of the levels we can get to today. Was this man originally the king or not originally the king? If he were originally the king, then the way the portion should have began, when it introduced the character, it should have said, and with this last statement, it should have been the beginning, and Balak, the son of Tzipor, was the king of Moab. And he sees the Jews had come out of Egypt. And he sees, apparently, when the whole discussion begins, he wasn't king. But he uses his anti-Semitic rhetoric in order to catapult him to become leader. Does that sound familiar? Which means, here you have an opportunist who sees something, captures the feeling of the people, understands the way the winds are blowing, and uses the fear of the people in order to make himself leader. And also, just to avoid confusion, we have two different nations that are mentioned right here. Midian and Moab. Midian and Moab. And what do? Vayishlach malachim, they send messengers, El Bilam ben Ba'or, to our notorious, talented, anti-Semite, Bilam ben Ba'or, Pitora, to a place called Pitor, Asher al Hanahar, which is by the river. If you live in the Middle East, some of you are visiting here now, right? What is the river? With a capital R. It's the Euphrates. Yeah, was that your guess? No. Nile? No. Which one? Jordan. Jordan, no. Jordan's like a little puddle. The Euphrates, that's... okay. The Euphrates, that's a river. So he sent to the Nahar, all the way up, Eretz b'nei amo l'krolo, to call him, to summon him, and to... Now, for those of you who have no idea what's going on, again, I told you there's a subtext. First of all, they send all the way back a message to this particular place. Why do they send to this place? So you can just say again simplistically that they heard about this guy named Bilam and he's a very talented person. There's something else going on. In order to understand this, who is Bilam? Sorry, let's start before that. Who is Balak? We're told he's the king of Moab. Who are the two people that have problems over here with the Jews coming out? The two different nations were mentioned in one breath. One was Midian, and the other was Moab. Who are these people? These are people that live around the biblical land of Israel, and these are people that are quite concerned that the Jews are going to come, and quite concerned that the Jews are going to wipe them out. And it's fascinating, because what would you expect a pagan to do. I mean, I hope this doesn't sound like I'm prejudiced against pagans, but pagans have certain sensibilities. And one of the sensibilities of paganism is might makes right. And what do you do when somebody threatens you? You try to annihilate them, right? You go to war. War is great. War is fun, right? Why in the world are they not doing the obvious? Why aren't they creating a confederation of all of the peoples that control this land? Why aren't they putting together a massive army, go to war, and destroy the Jewish people? Is that a good question or no? Yes, you like the question or no? You don't like the question? Why not? So get more people, get more soldiers. What's the answer? Why aren't they doing this? There's a deeper answer why they're not doing it, yeah? So what do they know this? Do they care about this?
Israel heard about what God had
done. Okay, so let me help you. As I said, you're missing a little piece of information. And once I say it, then you'll realize that this is correct. That's one of the things that Rashi points out, that they had always fought against themselves, but now at least they're brought together on this issue. But again, my question is, and your answer isn't satisfactory. Find more people, find more soldiers, find more people that hate them, find more people that feel threatened by them. I mean, ultimately, they're going to be at least 7 different nations. Ultimately, you're going to find dozens of kings that are threatened by the Jews. Bring all these people together and go to war. Listen, war is good for economy, right? Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
It seems like Balak decided to take it upon himself to lead.
But why this solution? Meaning, why not lead to battle? I'm saying that would have been the more expected pagan response. So as I said, there's something else going on over here. You have an answer? You like your answer? You still sticking to it? Don't let me intimidate you. It's much more fun if you resist. The answer is, it depends on if you know who these people are, who these nations are. Who is Moab and who is Midian? Let's start with Moab. Moab is the person, Moab, who has a nation following him. He's Abraham's nephew. Sorry, nephew's son. Abraham's nephew is a man named Lot. Lot had an illicit relationship with his daughter. As a matter of fact, it was even worse than that. Lot was drunk as, I guess, Lot, for lack of anyone else. Lot was dead drunk. This is after the city of Sodom is destroyed. And his daughters then say, well, there's no one else left in the world. And they go and they get their father drunk and they seduce him. And each gets impregnated by him. And what's interesting about Moab is the name Moab means from the father. Me'av, from the father. Which means Moab is the incestuous child. Incestuous, is that the word? The incestuous child that resulted from the incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. But go back, who's Lot? Lot is Abraham's nephew. Lot grew up in Abraham's home. Lot saw what Abraham's power was. Lot knows of the relationship that Abraham has with God. Lot certainly teaches his children something. And by the way, it's interesting. The Jews turn to them and say, let us go in. They say, no, we won't let you go in. We're not letting you in. And by the way, later on in the Torah tells us that we're not allowed to marry someone from the people of Moab. Why? It's fascinating. What does the Torah say? Because they didn't greet you when you came out of the desert. Hold it. What do they didn't greet you? Which means that they're holding the nation of Moab to which standards? To the standards of Avraham. Which means as Avraham stood by the desert and opened up his tent and had everybody come in, see, this is the downside of growing up in Abraham's house. Now you're expected to live on the same standards. Now you're expected. You've seen this. You've seen morality. You've seen kindness. It's not something you've never seen before. You're expected now to practice it. Which means knowing Abraham's greatness creates responsibility to act the same way. And what do they do instead? They know Abraham's greatness, and they say, damn, we better find something that can counteract this kind of greatness. And where do they go? They go back to the Euphrates. Where do they go back? Back to Nahar. What's there? So I'll tell you a secret, what's there. It's Abraham's hometown. Which means they're going all the way back to the core where Abraham came from. Now, there happens to be a guy there, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but there happens to be a guy there who is an Abraham imposter. What's his name? Bilam. Which means, what's the difference between him and Abraham? He's the guy you can find in the Yellow Pages. Right? You look up Abraham, right? You'll find Bilam's thing over there. He's the guy who has a big shingle on the right. It says Kabbalah, right? He's the guy that will claim that he has all kinds of gifts and all kinds of powers and all kinds of an ability. And the person who he patterns himself on is Abraham, but of course he takes all the opposite traits of Abraham. He is an imposter. But he's their hope. As I said, I got ahead of myself a little bit. Who's the other nation who's over here? Midian. Where does Midian come from? So it's okay. Any of you go out to dinner Friday night, and you have any hosts, you can ask them this question. Who is Midian? So I'll tell you who's Midian's father, just in case you don't remember. Somebody you know. A biblical figure who you know. Anyone? Abraham. You say, hold it. He had more kids? Yes. Before he dies, after Sarah dies, it says he has another wife, Keturah, and it says that he has some children. Guess what his son's name is? Midian. Which means, here you have somebody who grows up in Abraham's tent. Here you have somebody who grows up in Abraham's tent. Here they have the children of Abraham, and he sent them away. Correct. That's Midian. So now, here you have the two counterfeit children of Abraham. And the reason I say counterfeit, who was the original child of Abraham before he had any children? Lot. Before he had any children, who was the person who should have inherited? The person who saw himself as Abraham's progeny? Lot. By the way, Lot is one of the biggest tragedies in the Bible. Here's a man who grows up in the home of the greatest man in history at that point, and we can make a good argument for at any point. He grows up in the home of the greatest man in history who has adopted him, who treats him as a son, but he can't seem to make everything work. And he ends up, again, think of the joke, rather than being second fiddle, quote unquote, okay, for the people that are more sophisticated, that would be second violin, okay? Better than being second in charge in Abraham's tent, he'd rather be the chief rabbi of Sodom. One second. Does that sound like a bad joke, to be chief rabbi of Sodom? It looks good on a resume. I was once offered to become chief rabbi of Kenya and all middle Africa. At the point, I turned it down because of education for the kids. Had I known how bad education was here, I would have taken the job. But it's true. I was offered this position. And I thought about it. I should take it at least for a little bit of time. I could put it on my resume afterwards, right? Maybe I can still get Stone. Chief Rabbi of Stone. It sounds good. It certainly sounds good. But do you realize how tragic this is? You can grow up in Abraham's home. You can watch every single thing. You can even be in the background as Abraham is having an epiphany, as God is speaking to him, but you'd rather be Chief Rabbi of Stone. That's a tragedy. It's not easy to be around greatness. It's not easy to be in the shadows. Lot opts for being the judge of an immoral place. Again, you realize that's a joke? He becomes the judge of Sodom. Who put you in charge, they say to us? Who made you judge? He goes in order to be the moral person of Sodom. There's a problem there because he had an alternative. And by the way, when you realize that even Abraham, who's opening up his tent for everybody, is saying to Lot, listen, Lot, this is not working. You go left, I'll go right. You go right, I'll go left. Take your choice, wherever you want. You realize that if you got on Abraham's bad side, that there's something quite tragic over here. So now you realize something. These two people, Moab and Midian, these two nations, see, my answer is better than yours. These two, leave this to the professionals. These two nations, they're scared. Why are they scared? Because deep down, they know who Abraham is. See, God made a covenant with Abraham. What was the covenant? Your children will be enslaved. Why? Why do we need slavery? We needed slavery to create moral sensitivity. We needed slavery to know what it was like to be disenfranchised. We needed slavery to feel in our very bones, in the very core of our beings, what it's like to be taken advantage of, what it's like to be abused, in order that we should feel other people's abuse afterwards. Of all of Abraham's children, only one accepts this. That's Isaac. Of all of Isaac's children, which is two, of both of Isaac, one accepts, that's Jacob. All 12 of Jacob's children accept this upon themselves, which means they accept the covenant. By the way, there were two parts of the covenant. Remember the two parts? One part was, you'll be slaves for 400 years. What was the other part? When you come out of slavery, you receive the land of Israel. God promised them the land. But they had to deserve the land. The slavery was a part of the story. Now the Jews have left slavery. They have all of their scars, physical and emotional. And they march out of the land of Egypt. They march to Mount Sinai. They receive the Torah, which reminds us multiple times, some 36 different times, don't treat people the way that you would treat it in Egypt. Now you know what it's like to be slaves. And now they march towards the land of Israel. After 40 years in the desert, they march towards the land. And now these people are scared. Why are they scared? Because what do they know deep down inside? That they don't deserve to stay. What do they know deep down inside? That here are the rightful owners. What do they know deep down inside? That God made a covenant with Abraham. What do they know deep down inside? These are the righteous children, descendants. These are the rightful heirs of this land. And all the power goes back to Abraham. And Bala comes up with his great plan. Let me counterbalance Abraham. So when I said before that we have a conversation of non-Jews talking about Jews, these are not uneducated non-Jews. These are people that grew up in a Jewish home. These are people that understand Yiddish. These are people that understand what Jewish values are. And they look for the weakness. And the first way they think, they say, let's try to counterbalance the Abraham quality. And let's try to get some other type of Abraham who can curse them. And ironically, what does the Torah tell us about Abraham? What does God say to him at the very beginning? Whoever you bless will be blessed. Whoever you curse will be cursed. And these people are blessed. So now what do they have instead? Now they're going to take Bilam, who apparently claims that whoever he blesses is blessed, whoever he curses is cursed. What does he claim? He claims that he is the true Abraham, and he has these capabilities. And that's why they go back to Abraham's hometown. And that's why specifically these people, they're not going to go to battle. Because they know that when it comes to going to battle, they're not going to win. They know that the other side has more merit than they do. And they know they have to do something. And the first thing that comes to mind is, let's get a new Abraham and fight. And fight on a spiritual plane. And that's why specifically these people come to this conclusion. Of course it doesn't work. And one of the ironies is, you know, Abraham goes riding off on his donkey, and you have over here Bilam riding off on his donkey. The rabbis, by the way, make a big deal of the fact that Abraham's donkey was a male donkey, and this was a female donkey, and there's all kinds of sexual undertones, which the rabbis accuse Bilam of practically every bad thing you can imagine, and some you can't imagine. Everything they accuse him of. They have the donkey talking, which itself may be a comment on Bilam himself. It may be the Torah's way of making fun of Bilam, even, and say, you claim to be a prophet, you know, who is it who puts the words into the mouths of man to give man ability to speak? And ultimately, he finds an inability of cursing the people, and instead they bless the people. Because ultimately, what's the truth? The Jews are blessed. And ultimately, that's something he can't change. And that's ultimately something where he does not have enough power. So then you go to plan B. What's plan B? Now, if you're coming from Moab, and as I said, it's, I have to see how deep we can get on this. If you're coming from Moab, where does Moab come from? Moab comes from an ancestral relationship. Part of the problem of growing up in Abraham's home is the incredible standards that he sets. The other part of the problem is getting the formula down right. It's very hard to imitate greatness. Abraham, in a historical level and on a mystical level, represents the concept of chesed. Chesed means kindness. Abraham teaches the world chesed. What is chesed? Chesed means to give. Chesed means to give of yourself. Chesed means to share. Is there a possibility of corruption of chesed? The answer is yes. And mainly this problem is introduced when it comes into the whole realm of sexuality. Because chesed means I should love my neighbor as myself. How far or how close is that of loving my neighbor's spouse as myself? Where exactly do you draw the line? How do, on the one hand, do you create a society of giving, while on the other hand, keeping standards of types of giving, which is inappropriate? I mean, look at the 60s. The 60s spoke of free love. Free love is wonderful. But what did they do instead of free love? It free sex. Now, free sex is not the same thing as free love. But it was close enough that they were able to confuse the two. If the whole banner would have been, we need to show more love. I said in the beginning, it's the greatest human resource. But why was there a confusion between love, which is an emotion, versus sexuality, which is a biological or behavioral need? Why was there that confusion? Because, by the way, it's easier to have sexual intercourse with someone than it is to love someone. And by the way, where have we gotten to because of that? We've created today a society which is incredibly confused. We live in a society today that people are more willing take their clothes off and show someone else their body than they are to share their soul with somebody else. People are frightened of it as anything to share their soul. My body? That's easy. And think about the difficulty of having a real relationship if you can't share your soul. Think of the difficulty of having a relationship if you're not even familiar with your soul. If you haven't found your soul, then how are you supposed to share it? But it's so much easier, as I say, to replace the spiritual with something which is physical. This is not something new. This very strange border between love and sex, and as I said, chesed, is a crucial aspect of it. So much so that when the Torah speaks about the prohibition of incest between siblings, the Torah says, this is prohibited, chesed hu, this is chesed. It uses the word chesed. This is an inappropriate application of chesed, which means it's great if a brother loves his sister, but only if it's an emotional love. Physically, you've just gone past something that never should have been broached. But there seems to have always been this kind of problem, because as I said, it's easier to share physically sometimes than it is to share emotionally and spiritually. When you see Lot coming out of stone, which is an anti-chesed society, and you see his children then engaging in incest, what do you realize then is taking place? It is an overexpression of kindness, which is extreme, which is wrong, but perhaps was the reaction of living in a society that shut down all acts of kindness. That their response is, we need to be kind, but they do it wrong. But I'm saying that's always an issue in terms of sexuality. And it's not something we find the problem in Abraham's house, although the rabbis do accuse Ishmael of this. Now, it's interesting. When you look at Isaac, Yitzchak, he's a man of law, man of judgment. In the Kabbalistic terminology, Yitzchak is Gevurah, is Din. Ezehu Gibor or Kovish is Yitzro. He's considered to be strong, somebody practices self-control. If you're more familiar, if you're less familiar with Kabbalistic terminology and you're more familiar with modern philosophy, so you have Abraham, which would therefore be the beginning, which is the thesis, which is Chesed. You then have Yitzchak, which is the antithesis, and then you have Jacob, who merges the true and creates a synthesis. That's the Kabbalistic concept, by the way. It's not just Hegelian philosophy. The Kabbalistic concept is that Jacob creates a synthesis between the two. And Judaism needs to live constantly with a balance and a counterbalance of trying to reach out and creating chesed opportunities, but on the same time, creating boundaries. And ultimately, within the synthesis, both exist. When I say they both exist, it's not the synthesis is someplace 50-50, someplace in between the two. It creates a new reality which encapsulates both the thesis and the antithesis, creating a new thing, which is a synthesis, which is both a world of chesed, a world of kindness, and a world of boundaries, but somehow coming together as one, which means I can create a new society full of love, full of sharing, which, by the way, that's what Bilam sees on the outside looking at the Jewish camp. He sees something unbelievable. He sees something, and that's when he gives up. He blesses them and moves on. But what does Balak do? Balak, who comes from Moab, what does he do? He knows what the weakness is. He gets the girls, the women, the cheerleaders, to go down and try to seduce the Jews. And that succeeds. Had they gone to battle, the Jews would have won. When he tries to curse them, he can't curse them. But when he says, let's be nice to them, that's harder. By the way, when the history of American Jewry is finally written, some cynic will open up the book where they will contrast what happened in European Jewry between, whatever you want to say, 1,000 years, between the year 1,000 or whenever the first crusade, you can say, from the first crusade all the way through the final solution, and they're going to have a history of anti-Semitism. And then they're going to show, but look what happened in America. Which means you have two different Jewish experiences, those who hate us and those who love us. And the cynic is going to say, I don't know which one is worse. Because the Jewish people are disappearing today because of the wonderful opportunities we have. And don't get me wrong, America is the greatest country the Jews have ever experienced. But there's a downside to that, to the kindness. There's a downside to the opportunities. It's a very frightening thought. They send the daughters down, and the Jews very, very quickly end up becoming seduced, physically, emotionally, spiritually, moving all the way towards actually performing idolatry. And this portion ends with catastrophe. It ends with a plague sweeping through the camp. It ends with 24,000 people who die during this plague. Apparently 24,000 people were involved in this. So we have 3 minutes left to 4 minutes left. Let me try to take this a little bit deeper. According to the mystical view, there's a connection between these 24,000 who die and the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva who we find dying at a later point in history. The 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva were told they died because they didn't treat one another properly, which means they didn't practice any chesed. These 24,000 people died because there were no boundaries. The boundaries disappeared. And you had an over extension in terms of kindness. In the mystical writings as well, we find the following. And if you want to see the most remarkable statement about this, there's a book which is called the Mei Shiloach, which you most likely won't find. But in the Mei Shiloach, he even goes so far as to say that Zimri, the one who's guilty of he's the leader of the Jews involved in this whole outrage that takes place, he himself grabs this non-Jewish woman called Cosby, and they have sexual relations either out in public or at least everyone knows about it. And he says there was something very deep taking place. And when we first hear this, as a matter of fact, on a very deep mystical level, they were right, which goes absolutely against everything that I ever heard of and that you ever heard of, but I need to try to explain it. He tells us that Cosby and Zimri were reincarnations of two different souls. Which souls? The souls of a person called Shechem and a person called Dinah. And what happens when Shechem and Dinah have a relationship? The sons of Jacob come in and wipe out the city. And according to at least one of the writers, there were 24,000 people in Shechem that were killed. But let me go a little bit further to explain this. When Yaakov, who's the combination, boundaries and love, comes into the land of Israel, what happens to his daughter? Let me even go a step before that. The previous generation. Yaakov was supposed to marry Rachel. What was supposed to happen to his wife, Leah? She was supposed to marry Esav. What would have happened if she married Esav? Could she have had an impact on him? Do we give up on the Esavs of the world? Instead, she marries Jacob. Her daughter, Dinah, we're told that when the Jews come back into the land, they hide her in a box so that Esav wouldn't see her. Here's the second opportunity of having somebody who could have had an impact on Esav, but we give up on Esav. Is there a price to be paid for this? Again, boundaries become so fascinating. And what happens instead? This person's called Shechem, sees her, falls in love with her, and I'm not going to get into the whole story now, but one thing which is left out, there's a crucial word which is left out in that portion, which some people read into it, but it's not there. Go back and look. Did Shechem rape Dinah, or did Shechem fall in love with Dinah? So a lot of people read it and says it must have been that he raped her. It never says that. Matter of fact, it is something contrary to the rape scenario, because it says that after they were together, it says that he falls in love with her. Rape is an act of violence. And it's very unlikely that following rape there would be love. You know what? You have rape in the Bible. Amnon rapes Tamar. And what happens after physically he has her? He hates her afterwards. He can't look at her afterwards because he sees in her his own weakness. He sees in her his own inconsistencies. Over here, Shechem falls in love with her and says, I want to marry her. And the brothers say, well, you have to be like us. You'll have to have circumcision. It's fine. Matter of fact, well, the whole city will. And you have a whole city who are willing to become Jews. And what do the sons of Jacob do? They go and they wipe out the whole city. As I said, according to at least one mystical source, there are 24,000 people there. And they go and they grab their sister, Dinah, and they take her back home. Because we have boundaries. Matter of fact, when they get to Shechem, the city of Shechem, it says, Vayichan Esa'ir, creates boundaries around the city. Yaakov created boundaries. Dinah crossed the boundary. The brothers felt that this was an outrage. And they felt that this was sex and it wasn't love. And they felt that this was something that should be stopped. The Mei Shiloach claims that on a spiritual level, something needed to be fixed over here. And what needed to be fixed, we now have the next generation or the next possibility between Zimri and Cosby. Of course, it doesn't work out well and 24,000 people die. But then we get to the students of Rabbi Akiva. Again, they die because of no boundaries. The students of Rabbi Akiva create too many boundaries. They die because they don't treat one another nicely. There's no boundaries whatsoever. There's too many boundaries, and the too many boundaries creates a society which isn't kind. There's no kindness. That society can't exist, and the 24,000 are wiped out. Once again, according to the more mystical writers, the point where you have a slight amount of healing is that Rabbi Akiva himself is descendant of non-Jews. Rabbi Akiva is a son of a convert. Rabbi Akiva ends up marrying a non-Jewish woman who converts. The wife of one of the people who was one of the persecutors of the Jews, and he brings her into the fold. And at that moment we have Rabbi Akiva, who was the person who probably more than anyone else identifies with Abraham, love your neighbor as yourself, reaching out, says that's the most important rule of the Torah. On the one hand, he knows how to create boundaries. On the other hand, he knows how to love, and he knows how to teach, he'll try to teach his students about love. But we have over here, again, and this is the way this ends up, and we're not going to end up with a resolution. We have an incredible difficulty. Our difficulty is on the one hand of creating boundaries, which need to be, because otherwise you have absolute chaos. And on the other hand, being able to share love and to show love. How to create a society of children who will love one another, of adults who will love one another, of people who will share with one another, but still with boundaries, where morality remains and morality grows. We've seen too many generations who've either have gone in one direction or the other. That's the tension at the end of the parsha. That's the tension at the end of this week's teaching, which, as I said, is not easily resolved. But the sad part is, where the Jews are able to create something which is seen from the outside, from the inside, we don't always see it. Maybe we need to give ourselves a little bit more credit, and maybe sometimes we need to look from the outside in, and because we only from the inside see blemishes. And we need to look from the outside and to see, wow, what an incredible people who are able to be so kind and able to be moral. Again, it's a delicate balance, it's a difficult balance, but that's the challenge that God gave to us. That's our mandate, and that's the kind of people that we want to try to be. People that on the one hand are absolutely full of love and sharing, but people on the other hand who create a society of morality and of boundaries. Try to make love and boundaries. I didn't say sex. Try to create love and boundaries. It's not an easy thing, but as I said at the very beginning, love is the greatest natural resource in this planet. The more you do it, the more you share, the more it grows. It's a shame that we're so afraid to share it. Have a good Shabbos. What? I don't know what you're referring to.
Loving, kindness, and
so we're Rabbi Aaron Levitz. Can you meet us here?
Okay. Very nice. I heard you get the double mazel tov.
Yes.
Did you email me right after the
Yes.
We haven't been here since.
We're here when you
get back,
yeah, please send my regards.
Yeah, we'll be glad to know we have to.